From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The images of migrants struggling in the seas off Europe and Southeast Asia are heartbreaking. Thousands and thousands coming, many, many dying. Just today, Malaysia has turned away two boats with an estimated 800 people on board after another 1,000 landed on its shores. Europe locked in a debate now over how to share the burden or try to turn back the waves. And on a crowded planet of turmoil and climate change, fear this could get a lot worse. This hour on Point, the migrant crisis and how to respond. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Is this the future right now? What's the answer? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. A couple of migrant crises in front of us right now. Europe, we've seen a lot of out of North Africa and Libya. In Southeast Asia, we've had migrants coming out of Myanmar. The BBC's Jonathan Head just today, hours ago, next to a boat of Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar stranded in the Andaman Sea, southwest of Myanmar. Here he is.
It's packed full of, well, we can see at least 150 people on board. They say they are from Myanmar, from Burma. They're Rohingya Muslims, and that they're absolutely desperately hungry and thirsty. They've been calling out to us for help. We believe help is on the way. The Thai Navy's come to look at them, but we're not sure how quickly they're going to get it. We've been throwing them everything we have, all the bottles of water we have on board. But you can see there are women and children on board, and they've made a very long journey. We don't know quite how long they've been at sea, but it could be many, many weeks. And they've been abandoned by their crew.
Let's go first to this face of the migrant crisis right now. Joining us first from Yangon, Myanmar, is Robin McDowell, reporter for the Associated Press. Migrant boats spilling out of Myanmar or Burma and Bangladesh have been making headlines this week. Robin, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Sure, thank you.
This is a migrant flow that's been going on for some time. Why do we have this sudden crisis with boats bobbing at sea full of hundreds of people and no one apparently willing to take them in?
Yes, this is a problem that has been going on for decades and intensified after Burma moved from dictatorship to democracy 4 years ago. Up until I'd say November, there was a very clear smuggling network and route for these Rohingya Muslims who are fleeing persecution from discriminatory policies and attack violence from mobs in some cases. Recently, they crackdowned on human trafficking networks in Thailand, which has always been the first stop, have forced smugglers to change their tactics. In the past, the boatloads from the Bay of Bengal would go to Thailand, drop off the Rohingya and also Bangladeshi in Thailand, where they would be brought to jungle camps and held until ransoms were collected from their families. They needed this money to continue their journey onward, usually to Malaysia. When the crackdown on traffickers really started getting stringent, 2 months ago especially, the people were on the boat. The smugglers changed tactics again, and instead of bringing them to the jungle camps, they kept them on large ships in the Andaman Sea and waited until family members could come up with the money and then let them get into smaller boats to the border of Thailand and Malaysia, basically, and they would march them across the border. As things got really tough in Thailand, and you started seeing a lot of arrests of not only traffickers but also police and politicians, the captains and the brokers on the ships became too frightened to let the migrants get off the boat, and so they held them there. It was kind of a waiting game. In the meantime, more and more boats continued to come from the Bay of Bengal, and they didn't have any place to unload. So for a while, they were able to trickle out and get a couple of, maybe 1,000 people out in the last couple of weeks. But then when the crackdown got even harder, they stopped letting anyone get off. And that's basically what's happened. Now you have, by some estimates, 6,000, 7,000 migrants on the sea, mostly in the Malacca Strait between Indonesia and Malaysia.
Robin McDowell, there in Myanmar, we know that a lot of this is Buddhist nationalism in Myanmar that's always been focused against these Rohingya people. They don't even give them Myanmar citizenship. But in this current flow, or this flow over time, how much is political and cultural? How much is economic? I mean, these people are coming out of Bangladesh as well. This country, very vulnerable to rising seas and climate change problems.
I think we're seeing two separate things, really. The people who have been fleeing Myanmar, the Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar, have been fleeing persecution, not attacks only by Buddhist mobs, but really systematic discrimination that has prevented them from getting education, adequate health care, and even traveling between villages or outside of the state of Rakhine, where they are exclusively living right now. The violence in 2012 and that continued for several years, basically, forced 140,000 people into camps that are basically apartheid, living under apartheid-like conditions where they cannot leave those camps at all. So they have been fleeing primarily persecution at home. The boats still that are being filled up are situated between Bangladesh and Myanmar. The Bangladeshis, who make up almost half of the passengers now, are fleeing primarily because they're looking for economic opportunity. So you're really having a mix on those boats at the moment.
A very tough situation in Southeast Asia, and no resolution in sight right now as those boats bob off the shore. No one right now willing to take them. And you've got people who haven't eaten for days, some say weeks, running out of water and all the rest. It couldn't be more present. Robin McDowell, reporter with the Associated Press in Myanmar, Yangon. Thank you very much, Robin, for being with us.
All right, sure thing.
Let's turn to Europe. Joining me now from Brussels is Duncan Robinson, Brussels correspondent for the Financial Times. He's been covering the debate in Europe over how to respond to the influx of migrants, primarily out of North Africa lately. Duncan Robinson, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We see two things going on here now. One, a move to force all the countries of the EU to share the burden of incoming migrants. Another, to try and stop those boats before they ever leave Libya, maybe even sink them in the harbors in Libya. Bring us up to date on those two pushes, Duncan.
Yes, there are two factors here. The first is that Europe has a very unfair and uneven asylum system that the EU is attempting to reform. Because at the moment, you have a small number of countries taking the vast majority of asylum seekers.
Germany, Sweden.
Germany and Sweden, for instance, account for nearly half of all asylum applications. And so Brussels is currently working on proposals to share this out more evenly across all member states. For instance, Germany last year gave asylum to 40,000 people, while in Portugal only gave asylum to 40 people. And so there are big discrepancies that need to be ironed out. So that's one part. And the other part, which member states seem to be much more keen on, is the idea of some form of military intervention. There was a summit last month of all heads of governments across the EU, and this was the one factor that everyone was relatively unanimous on. They wanted to be seen to be doing something, and governments were more than willing to send in ships. However, this is a legally and technically difficult operation. So while the political leaders seem quite gung-ho, behind the scenes diplomats are slightly more concerned about how possible this mission is.
And the idea there would be to try and put a cork in this flow of migrants by actually sinking the traffickers' boats, what, in the harbors of Libya?
Whether that will happen in the harbors of Libya depends a lot on two factors. One, they would need a UN security resolution, which might be hard to come by because Russia is not particularly keen on the idea of another military operation by Western powers in Libya after 2011. The other solution would be to ask permission from the Libyan government. However, the Libyan government isn't exactly a beacon of stability at the moment.
There's a lot of talk about this happening, though. If it did happen, I've seen plans outlined of who would send what naval ships and attack helicopters and the rest and try and take these the migrant boats down before they're filled.
Yes, but the details are still very much being hammered out at the moment. The important thing to note is that this wouldn't be sinking migrant boats with migrants on it.
No.
So this would be often in international waters. So taking the migrants off and then disposing of the ship by whether sinking it or taking it back to a nearby port.
Duncan, what's your sense after the terrible images we've seen in recent weeks and the enormous flow coming out for all kinds of reasons? Is Europe more leaning toward building a kind of fortress against this or toward opening its doors in a humanitarian fashion to receive these waves?
Across national governments, the general theme seems to be we want a solution to this problem, but we do not want to have extra asylum seekers in our country. There's a huge problem across Europe with the rise of anti-immigrant parties. And so politicians are extremely wary of being seen to sort of throw open their doors to 1,000 more refugees. However, this means that the countries that are pulling their weight, such as Germany and Sweden, are doing far more than other states.
This was a big issue in elections in the United Kingdom just in the last few days.
Yes, certainly. It certainly is. And the new Conservative government are arguably the most critical of having mandatory sharing of asylum seekers across the EU. Now, the UK actually is allowed to opt out of these measures, so it is just making a noise on the sideline. But for countries such as Poland and Hungary, which are both very negative on the idea, they're going to have to lump it if other member states agree on this.
Is there any sign of the pressure of migrants out of North Africa easing, or is the flow still pressing against the Mediterranean there?
All NGOs seem to suggest that this flow is not going to stem anytime soon, not until you see a solution in places such as Syria or Eritrea or Libya. And a solution there does not seem to be on the horizon. So this is going to be a problem for the long haul.
Syria, Eritrea, Libya, and beyond. That is a wide swath. Duncan Robinson with the Financial Times, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about waves of migrants on the move right now in a world where this may be just the beginning. In Southeast Asia, as we speak, North Africa, on the shores of Europe, we've got some emergencies right now. Political upheaval and climate change may mean more to come. In the Andaman Sea, southwest of Myanmar, boats bobbing there right now with desperate people, no water, no food. BBC's Jonathan Head out next to one of them in another boat today, Rohingya Muslims in the Andaman Sea. Jonathan Head saying it was unclear who might step in to help them.
What we don't know is what will happen to them now. The countries in this region have been operating a policy of pushing them back, both Malaysia, Thailand, and Indonesia. And I think there'll be something of a tug of war about who is going to take responsibility for these people.
Here's one who made it ashore, Amina Hatu, a Rohingya migrant, paid more than $2,000 to traffickers, helped her get from Myanmar to Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia by boat after soldiers killed her in Myanmar. Buddhists killed her ethnic Rohingya relatives. The traffickers starved and beat her family, she said, held them for ransom until her mother paid for their release. In this interview just Tuesday, she spoke about her 8-year-old son who died during the journey. This is interpreted by Al Jazeera America.
My son was fine in the boat, but fell sick when we were in the jungle due to starvation. He vomited and had diarrhea. We drank sea water and there was no drinking water in the boat.
And in Europe, who's going to take these migrants? EU talking now about requiring everyone to share the burden. Not all countries there very gung-ho on that. Here was the Hungarian Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, a hardliner on immigration. He's against quotas. You must take this many of the migrants. He said early this month that it would be, he said, crazy to distribute migrants among EU member states. Here he is interpreted by Voice of America.
We don't want to see immigrants in Hungary. If other EU members ask our opinion, I say to them that I think you should not want them either.
But the migrants are out there, and the pressure is very real. Joining me now from Geneva, Switzerland, is Leonard Doyle, spokesperson for the Director General of the International Organization for Migration. The organization has 157 member states, promotes humane and orderly migration. Leonard Doyle, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Thank you very much for being here. And with us from Berkeley, California, is Solomon Xiang, a professor of public policy, University of California, Berkeley, faculty research fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research. He looks at how global warming will affect economies, security, and migration. Solomon Xiang, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Leonard Doyle, first to you. As a correspondent, I've watched migrant populations for many years, refugees, economic migrants, all kinds. We have the sense that we're in a period of particular emergency right now between North Africa and what we're seeing in Southeast Asia. This is your business. Do you feel a swell of this coming at countries right now?
Well, we certainly do. And a lot of it is, as you suggest, driven by conflict and natural disasters and indeed climate change. But we're also seeing, I think, what's really emerging very powerfully as a theme and as a trend is the fact of the huge economic inequalities between North and South, which are really encouraging people to vote with their feet. So when we see these boats landing in off the Mediterranean, it's causing, as we heard a few minutes ago, disruption and to the politics of Northern Europe, and people are voting more extremist, if you will, more right-wing. But the very same images played in an African village on globalized television nowadays is basically saying, come on in, you can get to Europe without a passport.
Your organization is being asked to set up shop deeper in Africa to try and stop this flow before it even gets to the Mediterranean. What's being contemplated there, Leonard?
Well, I think this is part of the European Commission's rather comprehensive proposals at this stage, and they include some of the things we heard about already, you know, distribution of refugees across the European Union, attacking the sources of the smugglers, if you will, although that's a highly problematic issue, saving lives of the migrants, and indeed trying to reach the migrants as they make their journeys through very arduous journeys, actually. And one of the main transit points is the landlocked country of Niger, where a lot of them end up and they get exploited. They often lose hope there and just get stuck. So we've been asked in this proposal from the European Commission to work on a migrant centre, in effect, to try and figure out who are the ones deserving of refugee status right there, rather than have them risk their lives and everything with the smuggling gangs of Libya who've been behaving abysmally, and indeed risking their lives in these rubber dinghies on the Mediterranean. So try and kind of pinch it off a little bit earlier and give people an opportunity to think before they move ahead into what's really a dreadful choice that they're making.
I mean, how would you do that? You're sitting now in Niger, you're south of the Sahara, I guess. They've got a long trek ahead of them and then a very dangerous boat ride if they can find a boat. What do you say to them to get them to turn around or give it up?
Well, that's the great question. I mean, many of them, of course, are determined to move on because they're in such a tough place. We do, you know, our research shows that they're mostly men, over 90% of them are men. They're between 15 and 35, and many of them have between 5 and 7 dependents. So it's really, they're carrying quite a burden on their back, and they've set off on this journey determined to help their families back home. So it's very difficult. You're certainly not going to persuade them by frightening them about the journey ahead. But we may be able to say, well, you know, if the chances of you getting across the Mediterranean are pretty good, maybe you won't get through the smugglers. And even then, when you do get to Italy, although you've seen photographs sent by your cousins and friends of people leaning against Lamborghinis, that's all fiction. So to some extent, we'll try and persuade them or try and help them understand that it's not easy street and that maybe it's a bad choice. But we're not against migration per se, of course. We just want people to make sensible, safe choices.
Are you going to give them a cash incentive to turn around? I'm reading that's a possibility here.
Well, that's something that happens. I mean, we have to make the distinction, of course, between refugees deserving of asylum and those economic migrants whom countries tend to put a cold shoulder to. And we try and offer suggestions for multiple different ways of handling that. Many countries like these migrants to go home, and to deport somebody is a very rough kind of justice for somebody whose only offence is to seek a job. So, and it's expensive. So quite often the International Organization for Migration can assist here. If people voluntarily want to go home, they're given a small grant and maybe they can set up a little business and they can go home with some dignity. So that's one option to give people that choice and help them to dissuade them from doing something that's potentially quite dangerous.
Trying to stop the tide, maybe, in Niger. Leonard Doyle, stand by in Geneva, Switzerland. Solomon Chung, I want to turn to you in Berkeley, California. And my question is this. In these movements of people that we see right now, do you see, Solomon, the result of particular moments of upheaval and circumstances? Syria, we all know about. Libya, we all know about. Eritrea has had its problems. The Rohingya people in Myanmar. Are these particular pushes underway right now that would have a sort of a lifespan and then be done? Or do you see a longer tide that's coming in here of migrant and migrant crises for some reason mounting, Solomon?
I think what you're alluding to is the fact that the climate is beginning to change now. As we see the climate shift, we're watching economic conditions, especially in the tropics and in arid regions, deteriorate. And that decreases the incentive for people to stay at home and increases their desire to leave and migrate, as Leonard was just talking about, to find economic opportunities elsewhere. And in many cases, we're observing types of upheaval, as you say, that look as though there's a component of them that is driven by existing climate change. And this is very familiar to us. In fact, if you look over the last century, there's many instances of massive migrations related to historical climatic changes. If you take, for example, and it's not always violent. So if we were to look, for example, in U.S. history, in the 1930s, the Dust Bowl caused roughly 3% of the population, 3.5 million people, to evacuate from the central United States and to move towards the coasts, causing crowding in cities there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I wonder, Leonard Doyle, when you look at this across a great span of time, there have always been migrations. I wonder if we just get excited or overexcited because now we have images of the suffering that go along with it. I mean, half of my family moved out of Sweden. They're now taking people. But, you know, a century and more ago, they had famine there. They had real economic problems there. Is this really new, or is human history just a story of migration and often not under sweet circumstances?
Well, I think you put your finger on it. I mean, it's often described as, you know, the ultimate coping strategy for human beings, whether it's climate change or economic dislocation or war. The people migrate, vote with their feet, and try and do better by their children. That's certainly the case. And I think what we're really seeing is the impact of huge global dislocation in income levels. And people can see it on their televisions, and they're not prepared to put up with it. I mean, you can live in a dust-blown place, you know, grinding your food every day with no hope and huge rates of infant mortality, no prospects of education. Or you can see on the television down in the village, you know, life is sweeter somewhere else. Not that it necessarily is, but that's the image.
Solomon Cheung, what about it? Maybe this is not so much climate change as just awareness that there are much more luxurious economies that people would like to be close to, and so they hit the road.
You're absolutely right that sort of current awareness is rising, but that's happening at the same time as climate change is progressing. And so I think we have both factors are contributing to a sort of an upward trend in awareness. There are increasing numbers of people being affected by climate change, being affected by economic deterioration caused by climate change, and being affected by conflicts that have some component of them driven by climate change. And so those things are all increasing at the same time that we have growing awareness. And I think that just both of those are happening in parallel. But it's important not to lose sight of the fact that as saddening as it is to observe what's happening now, there are actions we can take or not take that will make things better or worse in the future, in the several decades ahead of us.
I mean, right now, I think the consensus is that we're still not by any means on top of climate change. It still appears to be worsening, or circumstances will worsen. Some of that is baked in the cake already. If without some significant change on that front, what do you foresee in terms of migrant flows in the decades ahead, Solomon?
So it's important that we don't yet know exactly how to put a precise number on it. But if we base numbers on sort of historical patterns, how much populations in the past have moved in response to the climate, we can expect in the future substantial flows of individuals both within countries and between countries. And so historically, one pattern of migration that we see a lot of is actually not between countries, but people moving from rural places to urban places very quickly. So that's like what happened in the Dust Bowl, and we observed that historically in Indonesia and Africa just over recent decades. And then when the cities become sufficiently crowded, there's a greater incentive for people to move across to other countries. And so I think that that's only going to get worse, and seeing these images on TV help us sort of better conceptualize what the world is going to look like in the coming decades as things get worse.
Leonard, are we going to have to change our understanding of this? I mean, I'm reading here Graham Fuller, former CIA guy, blogging on this. His headline, "The Global Crisis of Refugees is the Ultimate Security Issue." He says, "The distribution of the world's resources, grossly inequitable. We all know that. I've got mine, maybe a knee-jerk reaction by local elites, but the whispers of apocalypse," this former CIA guy's writing, "can still be heard beyond the wall." Are we going to need some new response to this, whether it's higher walls or more open gates or else outreach into the areas which are so affected and or originating these migrant flows?
Well, I would just take predictions of current or former CIA officials with a pinch of salt to begin with.
Fair
but
enough.
What I would say is that, you know, let's not have a council of despair about this. Mm-hmm. Whether it's climatic or economic, ultimately there are political solutions to these things. A lot of the problem is governance. If you have appalling governance in a place, people don't stick around. We see The International Organization for Migration works with the government of Canada, for example, helping them bring farmers from the highlands of Guatemala to the planting areas around Toronto and Mississauga. So we recruit them, make sure they're not members of gangs, check if they have tattoos and the like, bring them up for a season of planting and farming and harvesting, and they come back. So what do? They pay the airline, they work extremely hard, they bring home some money to help, put a new roof on the house, to support the family, get some health care. There's no disruption and everybody is a winner. You have more competitive tomatoes coming in from Canada, etc. We need thinking like that from governments that will open its mind to circular migration, as it's generally called, or labour migration. Europe has been exporting people, including your forefathers, mm-hmm. for hundreds of years.
Yep.
They sort of need to think about it again if they want to remain competitive with an ageing population and with a willing workforce in sub-Saharan Africa. They've got to kind of get over themselves a little bit and try and figure out a managed process, or otherwise we're going to have these horrific scenes, I think, on our television screens for some time to come.
So don't see it just as a menace, but there's an opportunity. Canada here, as you described, sort of flying folks up from Guatemala. They work, they go back. Deliberate interlinking, kind of embracing it in a way, Leonard.
I think so. I mean, at the end of the day, migrants don't necessarily want to leave their homes. That's where their community is. That's where they feel safe. They leave because they have a sharp stick in their back, or they've run out of food, or whatever the ultimate reason is. But if political structures are there, if you have good governance, if you have proper structures, I mean, we have the Ebola crisis has now inspired us to go and help invest in West Africa mm-hmm. to get the healthcare structures back together. Well, we need that sort of support, I think, throughout sub-Saharan Africa. We can't assume that everybody's going to leave there, especially with the rate their populations are growing.
Let's bring our listeners in, if I may. Montreal, Canada. Edward is calling. Hi, Edward. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm struck by the foreseeability of this problem. I recall a book called The Pentagon's New Map that defined something called the functioning core, which included Europe and North America and other countries with functioning economies and that don't produce refugees. And your guest was speaking about how it's known that climate change will create climate refugees. So what I would like to see is for international institutions like the UNHCR to have a more proactive approach, a more concerted, prepared response to these, instead of the ad hoc approach that we're seeing from European leaders.
So get systematic about it. We can foresee a lot of it. Solomon Chung, to your mind, how much of the answer here lies in kind of emergency steps against more climate change versus getting systematic about the moval, the mobility of people and how we, so that it's not just desperate boats abandoned at sea or bobbing and starving?
I absolutely agree with both you and the listener that a systematic approach is both going to be more effective and also more fair. I think if we were to take a systematic approach, one thing is to reduce the incentive for people to leave, so to invest in economic development in these people's home countries. It's something we've been trying to do for a long time, and there's always much, much more we can do to try to reduce these global inequities that are encouraging people to move. And then, one of the other very important systematic investments we can make is trying to deal with climate change. Climate change is not the only problem, and it's important not to view it as such. But if we allow climate change to worsen, it's going to make things systematically worse around the world.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about waves of migrants on the move right now and a world where this may be just the beginning. In Southeast Asia, North Africa, on the shores of Europe, we've got some emergencies right now. Political upheaval and climate change may mean more to come. We're wrestling with what that may mean, both for the source countries for these migrants, for the destination countries. with Leonard Doyle, with us from Geneva, Switzerland. You're up in the middle of this right now, trying to decide how to apportion this flow among the people coming into Europe, or stop it, maybe, even sinking boats off of Libya before they can fill and go out to sea. And we've seen the death that has resulted there. Solomon Shung joins us from Berkeley, California, University of California there. He looks a lot at climate change and how it may impact these flows in the years ahead. Big impacts already. Here's Aisha, a 16-year-old Somali migrant living in a detention center in Libya. She crossed several countries to get their main gateway, Libya, for migrants traveling from Africa to Europe. Here's an interview with Al Jazeera America last Wednesday. She described the conditions in the detention center.
We don't eat anything 2 weeks, 3 weeks, only water, not food. That's difficult, and they beat us sometimes. They think we are animals, we're not people.
They think we are animals, we're not, we're people. In Southeast Asia, you've got boatloads floating right now, hundreds there. Here's Charles Santiago, Malaysian Minister of Parliament, part of the opposition coalition there, saying earlier this week that Malaysia and neighboring countries should save the migrants stranded near their shores.
Before we have dead bodies coming to our shores, that the governments, especially Indonesia, Malaysia and Thailand, send their boats out to search for these boats if they are there and bring them back to the land so that at least the food can be given and a bit of starvation and most importantly, there will be no death.
And so you hear the sound of that risk right there. Leonard Doyle, Solomon Shung, lots of response from our listeners online. I mean, Obrigado's looking, he says, right here in the United States, you have internally displaced people, can't afford to live in the cities they grew up in, moving south and west to cheaper areas like Latter-day Jodes. Okay, but it's not the same as taking to the seas and starving to death or dying of thirst there. Pollen writes, it's a border-free world for capital and cash flows, but not for poor people. And there is a kind of palpable tension in that. Sotwell writes, climate change and overpopulation will increase this issue. Somalia's been in a 4-year drought. No one's talking about that. There's a drought in other regions, too. Some analysts say the Syrian conflict and ISIS are a result of water shortages. Mara writes to us, says, Tom, how can you have a show about the immigrant crisis in Libya and not discuss the main cause of this crisis, that is, the U.S. and NATO attack on Libya that made it a failed state? Leonard Doyle, pick that one up, if you would. Is this crisis a consequence of the NATO and Western European intervention in Libya, or did that just open a portal for all this to flow out?
Well, I think, you know, whatever the West did from high in the skies over Libya, Muammar Gaddafi, you know, had set the scene for it long in advance, and there was a failed state there, you know, just held together by fear, I think. So I think it'd be a bit unfair to just to put it once again, blame it all on the West. There's plenty of players here with, and not least the Libyans themselves in this. But one thing we can see, though, is that we finally have international political attention on this issue, which has been bubbling in the background. The same number of migrants crossed the Mediterranean last year as this year. So it's not new. It's the deaths which really have, I think, brought it to our attention.
Here's Chuck writes to us. He says, how is it that these people can afford to pay a smuggler $2,000, which we heard earlier, to get out of their country, but can't buy an airplane ticket or find some other way to get out? I mean, help us just understand the mechanics of this, Leonard. I realize they may not be in a position to take a taxi to the airport and buy a ticket for the plane. On the other hand, $2,000 is a lot of money. You can fly from Southeast Asia to just about anywhere in the world for $2,000.
Of course, but these are people typically without passports, without papers. They, what will, at least in West Africa case, they will migrate, work their way up through to the various countries, paying a couple of $100 a time to get across the border. Working, often great, you know, greatly exploited, working out in the sun in really tough conditions. Ultimately, Libya has been a country of great work for migrants. There are people from Niger, for example, come there and don't go any further. They come and go all the time. So it's the chaos in Libya that's really a lot behind a lot of what we're seeing right now. But the amount of money paid, well, some of the times it comes from extortion of the families of the migrants who are in detention. So the militias or smuggling groups will grab them and then get on the cell phone and call their relatives in Europe or the United States or back home and say, unless a certain amount of money gets into this PayPal account or whatever account, you're not going to be hearing from your cousin again.
It's not exactly what they planned up front. We hear of people selling the whole family flock of goats or whatever it may be to try and save their relatives. Let's get a call from Boston. Zacharias is calling. Zacharias, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
What's your story?
My name is Zacharias. I'm from Eritrea originally, and I migrated to the U.S. 1986.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And my point is about the European Union. The solution, like, to destroy the boats in the coast of Libya. That's not the solution. They should go to the main source. The Eritrean people, they love their country. They've never been seen leaving their country like children, women, you know?
Yes. Why are they leaving, Zacharias? It's a long way from Eritrea to the shores of Libya. That's a long, dangerous way. Why are people doing it?
The European Union knows, the United States knows, the United Kingdom, the United Nations knows, it's the Eritrean government. There's a dictatorship sitting there for 20 years. They know about it. There are a lot of people in jail. There are some kids that were born in 1991 when Eritrea was independent. By the time they are 17 or 18, they're going to go to the national, service. Then there's not the end of it. It's like 10, 15 years, some of them.
But Zacharias, look, the NATO went into Libya to get rid of a dictator, and it's just turned into a big mess. Are you suggesting they should go into Eritrea also to take out a dictatorship?
No.
What then?
No, I'm not saying that. But they should, like, Eritrea, they got diplomatic relationship everywhere, you know? There could be a diplomatic sanctions, more economic sanctions. There's a Canadian company and a Chinese company in Eritrea who are digging gold. And these kids are working there, like, for years, for free.
Zacharias, I appreciate your call and your firsthand perspective on this. Leonard Doyle, there's, I think, a kind of a reaction now to Libya and other interventions, the Iraq war in the West, saying, let's just stay out. But Zacharias is saying, well, no, you don't have to go in militarily, but you've got to be engaged and care about the politics there, or they will come back to bite you with migrant flows.
Oh, he's absolutely right. I mean, you know, Libya is... You know, there's plenty of good people. We work with the mayors, for example, of some of the towns, and they're just being outrun by people who are making money from smuggling. If you just think of the math of it, like one large rubber dinghy that costs, I don't know what it costs, maybe $10,000 in the open market, even that, they fill it with 100 migrants paying $1,000 a pop. That's $100,000 for one small boat. So even this plan to kind of sink the smugglers' boats is a little bit... I mean, you can just replace it very quickly, given the amounts of money that are being earned. And what we're learning is that the people doing the smuggling, there's a whole chain of them, and at the heart of it, they're collecting large amounts of money and buying weaponry with it. So the Libyan state, you know, the border guards with their AK-47s, they just have to take a tea break when these guys come around with the heavy weaponry and bring the migrants through. And essentially, the absence of policy by Europe, the West, if you will, towards engaging with Libya has left a vacuum which we're now seeing being filled. And I think that's what's now being addressed. And that's when one hears concerns about the security side, there's a recognition that if you let this thing fester, it's going to get a lot worse.
So interesting. I mean, we welcome globalization in some ways and talk about it as though it is simply a fact. And in other ways, we still want the freedom to turn a blind eye and not care. Caroline in Newton, Massachusetts. Caroline, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Tom.
Yes.
I wanted to ask Leonard if he thought a social media campaign run by the IOM or UNHCR could be effective in reducing the number of economic migrants coming from some of these hotspots.
You mean send out, what, tweets on Twitter saying it's terrible out there, don't try it, it's not, or what, Caroline?
Well, not necessarily, you know, don't come, but to knock down some of the misinformation about the, you know, access to money and the, you know, the ease of getting to these new destinations, and maybe create a few incentives, you know, like a checklist, provide some resources, petition your ministry, look for government funding, maybe even more local places, destinations, cities, to check them before they make this huge journey.
That's interesting. I know that cell phones have made enormous inroads in Africa. Is it possible that there might at least be good advice given, Leonard, even if it's not as easy as think twice, don't come?
Well, look, it's really an excellent point. And I must say, if we'd had this conversation maybe a couple of years ago, we'd have been laughed out of court by the by the people who know how to do these things. But it's changing. And what the reasons it's changing is a couple of things. But one is this campaign for internet everywhere, so that everybody on the planet eventually will have at least one layer of internet or Facebook or Google on their simple phone, not even a smartphone. So what that does is it pushes the power of the internet into the hands of, you know, vast numbers of people, many of them really poorly educated, certainly poorly guided, and thereby pushes them into the hands of the smugglers. So we see a whole crop of little businesses on the Facebook side where people are offering their services. They're even advertising the time the boat's going to leave. So people are, you know, move with the technology, and in a, you know, in various, you know, windblown places of the world, perhaps the only thing that works is the internet shack, where there's a guy at one end dusting down his business to entice migrants, and the other end is maybe somebody selling the goats, as you suggested a few minutes ago. And certainly that's where we think the future is, in helping target migrants, if you will, with, you know, just at least give them safe choices and point out the potential hugely risky track that they're engaged on. At the end of the day, it's a persuasion game, and we have to move as fast as the technology is moving.
But at least be more deliberate about it. Matthew in Valdosta, Georgia. Thank you for calling, Matthew. You're on the air.
Thank you for having me.
What do you think?
Yeah, I was calling about the comment about investing into the economy of the immigrants. My comment is, I live, you know, in South Georgia, United States, and I know our government is strained itself. And I've been listening to the radio about the United Kingdom's government being strained financially. So my question is, with United States already having people born here and bred here and starving here, and already taking in refugees already from, you know, South America and everywhere else,
yes,
where is the financial money supposed to come from to invest in these economies? I mean, we're already sending materials overseas to rebuild everything that went on in Iraq. I mean, I think, you know, you should shut it, you know, basically shut your borders. I mean, we've already taken in more than what we can handle ourselves by trying to feed immigrants. We have starving, I know of many families in South Georgia who don't have enough food to feed their families.
Matthew, it's an obvious question, and let me put it to my guest, and I appreciate your call. Solomon Chung, how do you respond there? The resource issue around this. There's Matthew calling in and saying, look, it's no, you know, it's no deluxe boat that I'm in right here in Georgia. Where are the resources to deal with this problem globally?
I think Matthew's point is very important. It's exactly the type of things that we try to study when we design public policies. In particular, I was talking about the case of climate change, and we could imagine one strategy of coping with climate change is that as climate causes the economies in these regions to deteriorate, we could try to invest in these countries to compensate. But of course, that sounds very expensive. And in order to do that, we're going to have to take away from something at home. So if we want to avoid that incredibly expensive situation, we can try to think about what other options are. And so, of course, one option is to simply close our borders. And different people feel like there's different moral implications of that strategy. And then a different option is to simply invest in changing our energy infrastructure today so that we don't have to face that situation tomorrow. And what it's increasingly looking like is that that is the cheapest option, in fact. So what that so
we go to solar, go to wind, get off fossil fuels so we're not heating everything up and putting people on the move.
Exactly. People often talk about that as being an expensive form of energy, and for sure it's cheaper in the short run. It's more expensive in the short run than coal or oil, which we are using today. But it ends up costing us in the future by having to deal with either people knocking on our door or us trying to invest in their countries so that they don't.
Leonard Doyle, you were dismissive of our ex-CIA guy before, but he's sort of a born-again guy, this Graham Fuller. He says the problem must be dealt with at its source. Poverty, despair, the envy and hatreds and radicalism that spring from it. We cannot live forever in the gated communities of the West while Mad Max or Blade Runner rules operate outside the gates. This ex-CIA guy is saying, so what would happen if the USA devoted half of its military budget to these kinds of agricultural, health, educational, infrastructural needs in deprived areas? Solomon's pointing to our energy infrastructure at home. Graham Fuller says you've got to make the investment. You can't really close your borders anymore. It's just not doable. What about the investments that might be required here, Leonard?
No, I think it was a cheap shot. You're right. He's right. We need clearly to bring all the boats up. We need to bring all the economies up because we can't have everybody in the same place. But One thing that's, I think, not part of the conversation so far is the issue of governance. There are plenty of resource-rich countries that have seen, like, for example, Nigeria, that have seen the wealth of the nation just dribbled away and disappeared off to banks in Switzerland and what have you.
In the third world.
If we don't have good, honest governance where people feel properly represented, I think, you know, it's a losing game. And so much of, I think, what's needed is to give people a stake in their own society,
but how do you
get the politics right.
The United States, you know, George W. Bush made that case to take us into Iraq. That didn't work out so well.
Well, we're not talking about imposing democracy. That's another story. I think just giving people a stake in their own, in the development of their own societies, giving them the resources, enabling them to manage and to face up against a very stiff international competition that we're getting under the World Trade Agreement. I mean, we have to, at the end of the day, hope that all of these countries kind of get organized. We notice, for example, that there's not a lot of irregular migration coming through Morocco at the moment. It's because it's a well-organized country. Equally with Algeria. So it's not disasters everywhere, but there's plenty of them around. And I think where we see disasters, it's where you have weak governance.
Get organized, settle down, look at this very rationally, make the right investments, Solomon Shung says, in energy so that climate change doesn't exacerbate over time. Have a thought for those who are at sea right now. Grateful to the two of you for being with us so much of this hour. Leonard Doyle with the International Organization for Migration in Geneva. Good luck with your work in the face of these emergencies right now. And thank you for joining us today, Leonard.
Most welcome. A pleasure.
And Solomon Shung in Berkeley, California. Thanks so much, Solomon. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.